Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Hello.
Today, we're doing something a bit different. We're taking on a kind of technical appendix.
Yeah, it's like a review of foundational math concepts. We're talking counting, sequences, all the way to convergence.
Right, but our mission here isn't just to list definitions. We want to find the, surprising connections hidden inside these basics.
Exactly. How does something really simple, like counting things, somehow lead us to one of the most important numbers in math for growth?
You mean Euler's constant E?
That's the one. That's the core thread we're pulling on today, this unexpected link between discrete counting and E, which is all about continuous growth.
It's a pretty cool realization when you see it unfold.
It really is. You start off in this very neat, finite world of integers and arranging stuff, and suddenly the math itself pushes you towards the infinite, the continuous, just to make sense of how fast things are changing.
Okay, let's start that journey then. Theme one, the power of counting. And the fourth stop has to be the factorial, n.
Right? N factorial. It's just n times n1 times n2 all the way down to 1.
Simple multiplications. Like if you have three different colored balls, red, green, blue, how many ways can you line them up?
Three times two times one. Six ways.
Feels basic.
It is.
Yeah.
But man, does it grow fast. We were looking at the source, 10 factorial.
Yeah.
It's already over 3.6 million.
Wow. Just from 10 steps, it
Yeah.
really shows how complexity can like explode from simple rules.
Totally. And speaking of rules, there's that slightly weird one, zero factorial, zero equals one.
Ah, yes. That always feels a bit arbitrary. Why is it one?
Well, it's about logical consistency, which is kind of the bedrock of math,
I
right?
forget.
If n is the number of ways to arrange n objects, how many ways can you arrange zero objects?
None.
Well, there's one way, the state of having no arrangement at all, the empty arrangement.
Ah, okay. So it's like there's one possibility, which is the nothing is arranged possibility.
Exactly. And defining it that way makes all the other formulas work out nicely later on. It preserves the structure.
Got it. Consistency. So from arranging all the items, we move to selecting just some of them.
Right. And here we hit a crucial distinction, ordered versus unordered selection.
Permutations and combinations.
Yep. Super important in probability, data science, anywhere you're counting possibilities. A permutation, usually written PNK, is where the order you pick things in matters.
So picking Alice then Bob is different from picking Bob then Alice.
Exactly. The formula for that is N divided by NK. You basically divide out the arrangements of the items you didn't pick.
Okay, that's permutations. What about combinations? CNK or N choose K.
Now, order doesn't matter. We just care about the final group of K items, not the sequence they were picked in.
So Alice and Bob is the same group as Bob and Alice.
Precisely. And the math connects beautifully here. We know any specific group of K items can be arranged internally in K ways.
Right, from our factorial definition.
Since we don't care about those internal arrangements for combinations, we just take the total number of permutations, PSTAT, and divide out that redundancy we divide by K.
So CNK equals PNK divided by K,
Yeah.
which works out to N divided by K times NK.
You got it. It's not just some random formula. It flows directly from removing the duplicate orderings.
It makes sense. The logic is tight.
And this CNK, the combination number, it's also called the binomial coefficient.
Right, because it pops up when you expand something like a plus x to the power of n.
Exactly. CNNK is the coefficient of the term with ANK times XK. It tells you how many ways that specific combination of A's and X's can occur.
Which leads us straight to Pascal's triangle.
Yep, that beautiful triangular arrangement of all the binomial coefficients.
Like row 4 is 1, 4, 6, 4, 1.
Right. And the really neat thing isn't just the pattern, but the identity behind the pattern.
Which is?
Any number inside the triangle is just the sum of the two numbers directly above it.
So Cn plus 1, K, Cnk plus Cn, K next 1.
That's the one. It reflects a choice. When forming a group of K from n plus 1 items, you either include the n plus 1th item, so you need K1 from the first n, or you don't include it, so you need all K from the first n.
That's elegant. It builds itself. And what about the sum across a whole row, rown?
That's always 2 to the power of n.
Which represents?
The total number of possible subsets, including the empty set, and the full set you can make from n distinct items.
Wow. So we started just arranging items, and now we have this geometric structure that counts all possible groupings.
It's powerful stuff. And that power, especially the sheer speed of factorial growth, kind of forces our hand. We have to shift perspective.
To theme two, from counting to continuous growth. the exponential function.
Yeah, we saw n grows incredibly fast. Mm-hmm. How do we actually model that growth smoothly, continuously?
The source material hinted that n can be approximated using that constant e. Something like n is roughly e times now.
Sort of, yeah. We're looking for a constant, let's call it e, that kind of balances the growth rate.
Mm-hmm.
Mathematicians figured out that to get the rate of change right as you go from n to n plus 1, this constant e needs to be approximated by,
let me guess,
1 plus 1, especially for large values of n.
And there it is. That's the compound interest formula.
Bingo. That's the aha moment.
Uh-huh.
It feels like discovering a fundamental constant of nature through, like, bank interest.
Explain that connection again.
Okay, imagine you invest $1 at 100% annual interest rate. If they compound it just once a year, N1, you get 1 plus 11, 1, 1 is $2.
Simple enough.
If they compound twice a year, N2, you get 1 plus 12, 2 equals $2.25. A bit more.
Okay.
As you compound more and more frequently, monthly, daily, hourly, continuously, as N gets infinitely large.
Does the amount you get back become infinite?
No, and that's the amazing part. It doesn't blow up. It converges. It approaches a limit.
And that limit is?
Euler's constant, E. Approximately 2.71828. It's the natural limit of growth when the growth is proportional to the current amount, and it happens continuously.
So E isn't just some random number. It defines continuous growth itself.
You could say that.
Yeah.
And this idea extends directly to the exponential function, x. It's defined as the limit of 1 plus x and n as n goes to infinity, continuous growth at rate x.
And this understanding of E helps us approximate n better.
Immensely. It leads to Stirling's approximation, which is like the ultimate shortcut for factorials.
I remember seeing this one. It looks kind of wild. N is approximately the square root of 2 pi n times n.
That's it.
Okay, hold on. Pi. Square root of 2 pi n. Mm. Where does pi, the circle constant, come from when we're just counting arrangements? That seems unexpected.
It is unexpected, and it's beautiful, really shows how interconnected math is. The pi emerges because when you deal with approximations for large numbers and distributions of possibilities, you often end up involving the Gaussian function, the bell curve.
Okay.
And the normalization constant for the Gaussian integral involves the square root of pi. It's a deep link between discrete counting statistics and continuous probability distributions.
Wow. So the geometry of circles finds its way into counting large numbers of arrangements via probability curves.
In a nutshell, yeah. It's a fantastic bridge from discrete to continuous.
And the sources mentioned, this Stirling's formula is incredibly accurate, right? Even for small n.
Surprisingly so. It's designed for large n, but it's already about 90% accurate for N1 and hits 99% accuracy by NSB9. It's remarkably efficient.
Amazing. Okay, we've tackled growth, seen E emerge. Let's switch gears and ground ourselves firmly in geometry. Theme 3, vectors and complex numbers in the 2D plane.
Right. Back to basics. Vectors in R-row, the standard 2D plane. We can think of them as arrows starting at the origin, pointing to a coordinate, x, y.
Pretty straightforward. Adding vectors adds the components, scaling multiplies them. Easy enough.
But the real geometric insight comes from the dot product.
Okay, the dot product. Algebraically, it's simple. By 1 by 2 plus y1, y2.
Right. But geometrically, it's defined as the product of the lengths of the two vectors times the cosine of the angle between them. V1, V2, cos theta.
And the key takeaway is that these two definitions always give the same answer. The dot product identity.
Exactly. It connects the algebraic calculation to the geometric meaning.
Which definition tends to come first? Historically or conceptually, the algebra or the geometry?
Usually the geometric intuition thinking about lengths and angles comes first. The algebra is then developed as a way to calculate and formalize that geometric idea consistently.
Makes sense. The algebra serves the geometry.
And the identity immediately gives us something powerful, orthogonality. How do we know if two vectors are perpendicular?
Well, if they're perpendicular, the angle theta is 90 degrees. Cosine of 90 degrees is zero.
Yeah.
So their dot product must be zero.
Exactly. If and only if the dot product is zero, the vectors are orthogonal. Super useful.
Okay, so we have this 2D plane with vectors. Now let's think about it differently as a number system. Complex numbers.
Right. We take the same XY plane, but now we treat a point, XY, as a single number, Z if X plus IY.
Where I is the imaginary unit.
Defined by the fundamental identity. I squared equals negative 1. I august 1.
And this lets us do arithmetic in two dimensions. Addition is still like vector addition. But multiplication, that's where it gets interesting, geometrically.
Oh, yeah. Multiplying two complex numbers, z1 and z2, isn't just component shuffling. Geometrically, you multiply their magnitudes, their lengths or distances from the origin.
So R-E-A-R.
And you add their angles relative to the positive x-axis.
The I is theta plus theta. Multiplication involves rotation.
Precisely. The source used a great analogy, stacking shadows.
Explain that one.
Imagine z1 is already on the plane, casting its shadow. Multiplying by z2 is like giving z1 instructions. Stretch yourself by the magnitude of z2 and rotate yourself by the angle of z2.
So z2 acts on z1's shadow, rotating and scaling it to produce the final result.
Exactly. Multiplication is rotation and scaling in the complex plane.
That geometric view must be why roots of unity make sense. Finding a number omega where omega raised to the power d equals 1, omega equals 1.
Absolutely. Since multiplication adds angles, finding a d-layerth root of unity means finding a number whose angle, when added to itself d times, gets you back to a multiple of 360 degrees, or 2 pi radians.
And the magnitude has to stay at 1 if you start on the unit circle.
Right. So the d the roots of unity are just d points, equally spaced around the unit circle. Starting at 1, they form a regular d-sided polygon.
Deep symmetry, just sitting there in the planes arithmetic.
Hidden in plain sight.
Okay. Symmetry, structure, growth, geometry. These abstract ideas must connect to how we handle real-world information, right?
Definitely. Which brings us smoothly into theme 4, bridging math to data, specifically the Python SQL workflow.
How does this abstract math relate to databases and code?
Well, structurally, a database table isn't that different from common Python objects used for data. Think a list of dictionaries or a pandas data frame or even a JSON structure or a CSV file.
They all represent rows and columns, essentially.
Pretty much. And Python libraries are great at converting between these formats seamlessly.
What's the core philosophy for using SQL versus Python in data work, according to the sources?
It's about playing to their strengths. SQL is king for big manipulations on the server.
Like joining massive tables, filtering huge data sets, doing initial aggregations.
Exactly. Stuff you want the powerful database engine to handle efficiently across potentially terabytes of data.
And Python's role.
Python shines in detailed computations, usually done locally after you've pulled a more manageable subset of data from the database.
Like complex calculations, statistical modeling, building machine learning features.
Right. And this is where our vector math pops back up. Often those detailed computations involve creating feature vectors, maybe summarizing a customer's purchasing habits across categories.
Ah, so a customer becomes a point, a vector, in a high-dimensional space defined by product categories.
You got it. And then if you want to see how similar two customers are, you might use
dot product,
yep,
or related distance measures based on that vector geometry. It's not just abstract anymore.
Not at all. It's a practical tool. Let's look at the restaurant example from the source material.
Okay. They had records of dishes ordered and a separate menu with prices.
Right. So a detailed computation in Python might be calculating the subtotal for an order. You need to look up each dish's price from the menu data, multiply it by the quantity ordered from the orders data, and sum those up for every item on the ticket.
That requires precise item-by-item logic. Perfect for Python pandas.
Or calculating tax. Say you need to apply Connecticut's specific 7.35% rate, but only after adding the subtotal and any tip together. Python handles that custom logic easily.
Okay, so Python does the intricate work. But what about storing the result? Especially if an order has like 100 individual items.
That's where Python's flexibility helps again. You can take that complex list of ordered items, maybe with quantities and prices attached, and convert the whole structure into a single compact JSON string.
Ah. So instead of needing a whole separate table just for order items, you store the details as structured text.
Exactly. That one JSON string can then be stored neatly in a single text column within your main orders in SQL table.
Clever. You get the detail structure from Python, but keep the SQL table relatively simple and efficient for those big manipulations later.
It's a really common and effective pattern. Leverage Python's detail-oriented power locally, then store clean, manageable data back in SQL.
The best of both worlds. Flexible computation, efficient storage.
That efficiency is key. So we've traced a path, haven't we, from basic counting.
Through factorial growth and the emergence of E.
Grounded ourselves in the geometry of vectors and complex numbers.
And finally saw how that structure informs practical data workflows in Python and SQL.
It shows how these fundamental concepts aren't just theoretical. They underpin how we model growth, understand relationships, and even structure information.
Which brings us to the end of this deep dive. We saw counting lead to E, vector math defined angles, complex numbers handled rotation, and linked it all back to data.
And beyond just the definitions, it's often the properties of these functions and constants, their shape, their behavior, that make them so useful in more advanced areas.
Right. Which leads perfectly into a final thought for you, listener, to ponder. We met the exponential function, x, which came from continuous growth. Now, this function has a really important geometric property. It's convex.
Think of it like a bowl shape opening upwards.
Yeah, if you draw a straight line segment connecting any two points on the graph of y, graph x, that line segment will always lie above the curve itself. It never cuts underneath.
So given everything we've discussed today about geometry, structure, and growth,
here's the question. How might that specific bowl shape, that convexity of exponential growth, be useful when you're trying to solve problems involving minimization, like finding the lowest point of an error function in machine learning or optimizing a process?
It's a crucial property for understanding why algorithms like gradient descent work so well. How does that upward curve guarantee you can find a bottom?
Something to chew on. How geometry helps us find the minimum.
That's a great place to leave it.
Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.
Thank you.
See you next time.